Hello, my name's Dan Kalinski. I'm a QC at Landmark Chambers. One of my areas of specialism is non-domestic rates. In this podcast, I'm going to be discussing completion notices. Now, the first thing to understand about completion notices is their role in the wider non-domestic rates statutory scheme. So in order for liability to be imposed for rates, there needs to be a hereditament shown in the non-domestic rating list. Now that applies both for occupied rating liability under section 43 of the 1988 Act and in relation to unoccupied rates liability under section 45 of the 1988 Act. So the fundamental question then is, what is a hereditament? And to cut a long story short, the essential answer to that is a hereditament is a unit of property which is capable of beneficial occupation. So the completion notice mechanism is important because it resolves disputes as to whether or not a new building has reached the point at which it is capable of beneficial occupation. And so there are two types of completion notice. There is a completion notice which simply confirms the fact that property is capable of beneficial occupation. And there is a completion notice which deems property which would not otherwise be capable of beneficial occupation because it's nearly complete to be, after the elapsing of some time, complete, and therefore it facilitates the imposition of tax on a deemed counterfactual basis, namely that the property should be taken to be in a complete state. And this is important because it then allows for the tax to be imposed on this deemed basis. So the deeming goes both to the entry of the property in the rating list and to the way in which it is to be valued. It is to be valued as if it were complete. So this is a very powerful tool, either for putting a dispute as to the actual condition of a property beyond doubt, or to actually create this powerful deeming provision that tax is imposed not on the actual condition of the property, but on an assumed basis, and that assumption being an assumption against the ratepayer's interest, namely assuming that, notwithstanding the fact it's not quite complete, that it is to be taken to be complete. So the Act provides a machinery for resolving those disputes. And the essence of the machinery, in short, is that there is a mechanism called a completion notice, which the billing authority has to effectively draft and serve on the ratepayer. And if that is done, then there is the ability for the ratepayer to challenge the completion date, either by agreeing a different completion date with the billing authority, or for a dispute to be resolved by the valuation tribunal, who then determine what the completion notice date, the completion date, is. And once that mechanism has taken effect, then that translates back to section 46A of the 1988 Act, and there is a deemed completion date, or a completion date for the purpose of section 46A, which is to be treated as definitive. So when that statutory mechanism has played out, there is a definitive date which is imposed, and that is the completion date. The first question, though, is what happens if that mechanism is not triggered? And the short answer to that is that the property can only be entered in the rating list if it is actually complete, unless you go through the completion notice mechanism. And there are a couple of cases on that I just want to talk about first of all. So the first case is the case of Porter and Gladman from 2011. This concerned office buildings which, as it turned out, were not ready for occupation. They were quite close to being ready for occupation, but in their actual physical state, the tribunal held that they were not ready for occupation. And this is a really important decision of the then president, Mr. George Bartlett, with the very experienced member Norman Rose. And effectively, they confirm the critical importance in practical terms, in a modern office context, of serving completion notices, because they said in paragraph 66, a building is only a hereditament if it is ready for occupation, and whether it is ready for occupation is to be assessed in the light of the purpose for which it is designed to be occupied. If the building lacks features which have to be provided before it can be occupied for that purpose, and when provided will form part of the occupied hereditament and form the basis of its valuation, it does not constitute a hereditament and so does not fall to be shown in the rating list. There is in consequence no scope for including in the list a building which is nearly, even very nearly, ready for occupation unless the completion notice procedure has been followed. So in the office context, that case emphasised the critical practical importance of the completion notice procedure. In particular, that there was no way without a completion notice of imposing rates on an office building that was on the verge of completion but wasn't yet ready in its actual state to be occupied for the purposes for which it was designed to be occupied. Now, there was a sequel to Porter a couple of years later called Aviva and Whitney, and this was a case where the valuation officer sought to resist the application of the logic of Porter in a warehouse context. And that attempt was unsuccessful. In Whitby, the tribunal in essence reiterated the legal approach set out in Porter and confirmed its practical application in the warehouse context. And so in paragraph 89, the tribunal, which by then consisted of the then new vice president, Mr. Martin Roger, sitting with Norman Rose, who'd also sat in the Porter case, they said in paragraph 89, we reiterate what the upper tribunal said in paragraph 66 of Porter, namely that the issues which have arisen in these cases would have been avoided if each of the billing authorities had served completion notices at the time the units reached practical completion. There is simply no need for disputes of this kind when the statutory scheme provides a reliable method of deeming a new building to be complete and capable of being entered in the rating list. So in Aviva, it was a parallel situation. You had a warehouse which lacked some of the features necessary for it to be capable of beneficial occupation in its actual state. It was almost complete, but not quite. Valuation officer argued unsuccessfully that there was a different approach, a different standard of readiness for occupation to be applied in a warehouse context. Upper tribunal was having none of it, reiterated effectively the mechanism in the statutory scheme that if something is almost complete but not quite, then it's no good entering it in the rating list unless you've gone through the process of serving a completion notice. So the upshot of Porter and Aviva is to emphasise the critical practical importance of effectively triggering the mechanism in the statutory scheme for resolving disputes as to whether or not property is capable of beneficial occupation by way of serving a completion notice. So after Whitby and Porter, the machinery for serving completion notice took centre stage, and then there was a period of, if you like, skirmishes about how that machinery was to be triggered and the extent to which there were procedural tripwires under that machinery. And that has all played out now following, or much of that has played out now following the decision of the Supreme Court in the UKI Kingsway case. And so I'm going to talk about where we've ended up after UKI Kingsway for the rest of this podcast before I finally then make one or two observations about where we are now and what might not yet be resolved. But I'm going to turn next to the UKI Kingsway litigation. So the facts of UKI are quite simple. The billing authority wrote out a completion notice, and they had trouble working out who the owner of the property was. So they simply wrote the owner, and they took it to the address of the property, and they left it with a receptionist who, as it turned out, wasn't employed by the owner of the property, but by a facilities management company. And an email version of the notice actually reached the owner by a roundabout route, And the issue was whether the completion notice had been effective to trigger a completion date under Schedule 4A. And there were two points of arguments on the facts. One was, could service include indirect receipts? In other words, if the notice had reached the owner via the receptionist, could that be, who wasn't authorised to accept service, was that sufficient service? So indirect receipt, did that constitute sufficient service? And the second point was, did it matter that the hard copy had never in fact reached the owner, but only a scanned version by email? So that's the electronic service point. Now, the case went from the Valuation Tribunal to the Upper Tribunal to the Court of Appeal to the Supreme Court. And a noticeable feature of it was that there was a different outcome and a different analysis at each stage. So just very quickly, the Valuation Tribunal held that it hadn't been validly served. The Upper Tribunal held that everything was okay, eventual indirect receipt by the owner was enough, and it didn't matter that it was electronic. The Court of Appeal reversed that, saying that the indirect receipt via an unauthorised agent wasn't effective service because there was need for certainty in this tax context. And although it didn't finally determine the electronic receipt point, it was minded to consider that that wasn't good enough for it to be electronic receipt. And then it went to the Supreme Court. And I'll tell you in a little bit of detail what the Supreme Court did, but the short point is it reversed the Court of Appeal and it went back to the decision of the Upper Tribunal, but with slightly different reasoning. And I'm going to just discuss that reasoning and the implications of it in the remainder of this podcast. Before I do that, it's just worth reflecting on the fact that it's a short case, short point and short case that created all these different responses. And I think what's interesting about that is that there are these tensions both in rating and perhaps more widely in law between, if you like, formality and justice on the facts of any given case producing a fair result. Perhaps there are tensions reflecting property law, which built up around individuals where perhaps there's more procedural flexibility that's been allowed in certain circumstances against arguably sort of tax law where some formality and also a culture of protecting the taxpayer and requiring compliance by the state with formalities and procedures within the statutory scheme has more of a tradition. So completion notice for a while found itself in this frontier struggling for what the right level of emphasis was in a context where the courts were aware that this was a deeming tax provision, but also wanted to allow the law to function effectively without producing unexpected results and also creating what were perceived to be unjustified windfalls to ratepayers where there had been a small failure to comply with something which would end up having very considerable financial consequences. So these underlying tensions were playing out in the UKI Kingsway litigation. So back to the Supreme Court's approach. So the Supreme Court emphasised that the mechanisms in the statutory scheme for service, which are contained in Schedule 4A, were permissive and that their function was to create certainty as to whether service had taken place. So it wasn't essential for a billing authority to comply with them. And what they actually did was to pass on the risk of non-receipt to the ratepayer. So if you had carried out a function which was specifically identified as allowing service and the notice hadn't in fact arrived, then the billing authority could nevertheless rely upon the deemed service provision. So all of that is actually the application of the orthodox approach to service in landlord and tenant law, and it was confirmed that that was how that applied to the permissive service provisions within Schedule 4A. The real argument was about whether indirect receipt was enough, And the Supreme Court held that the critical question was whether or not the billing authority had caused the notice to be received by the ratepayer. And that was from Lord Carnworth's judgment. He used that expression in paragraphs 15, 32, and in the discussion in paragraphs 36 to 39 of the Supreme Court's decision. And he held, in the circumstances of UKI, that they had. He said there must be a causal connection between the authority's actions and the receipt of the notice by the recipient. The receptionist passing on the notice to the owner was, he considered, a natural consequence of the council's actions. That's paragraph 37. The fact that the council wasn't in control of anything, of the receptionist, wasn't fatal because, he said, causation does not necessarily depend upon control. He said there needs to be actual receipt of the notice and a sufficient causal link with the actions of the council for indirect receipt to count as service by the council. Now, all of that makes a lot of sense on the particular facts of UKI, that when the member of the council's team handed it to the reception, although there wasn't control over what the receptionist did, it was a foreseeable consequence that it would be passed on. It was a natural consequence, etc., etc. But it's not really clear how that's going to work in practice. It seems that the Supreme Court were differentiating other positions of unauthorised agents. So, for example, if you imagine a situation where there is a solicitor involved or a rating surveyor and an inquiry is made, are you willing to accept service of this notice? And they come back and they say no, then it may not be a natural consequence for it to be passed on. But it seems that the Supreme Court were differentiating that from the particular facts of UKI because they perceived there to be what was characterised as a purely mechanical role played by the receptionist in this case, see paragraph 31. But it's not quite clear how that's going to play out where other actors are handed a notice, they don't have authority to do anything to it. And as I say, there's some uncertainty as to the position of solicitors or rating practitioners who receive a notice, notwithstanding the fact they say they're not authorised. If they then pass it on, will this dicta catch them? And will that therefore put them in an invidious situation where their duties to their clients may require them to share information, but their understanding of the law might indicate that it wouldn't be in their client's interest to do that. So, and that's not satisfactorily addressed, I don't think, in the Supreme Court's reasoning. So I think it remains to be seen precisely how this test, which makes a lot of sense on the facts of UKI, will play out in other contexts. And overall, on that first point, the Supreme Court held in the particular circumstance of that case that indirect receipt was good enough and the notice had been served, and therefore the mechanism was for fixing the completion notice had been satisfied, subject to the electronic communications point. And the upshot of that is that they dealt with that very shortly and they held that service by email was okay, and that seems to make sense. And I'm recording this in lockdown, and service by email has obviously become absolutely critically important in lockdown circumstances where people aren't necessarily staffing offices, etc., etc. All of that seems to be modern, sensible, etc. But actually, there is, I think, some tensions there which weren't necessarily fully explored, because they took a very permissive approach to that. But there was an argument that effectively in the rating statutory scheme, there was a very cautious approach to electronic service, which was consensual in nature and applied to billing situations. And that was an indication against taking a wide and permissive approach to the service of completion notices, which were outside the reach of those provisions. But that was given very short shrift by the court, and they thought that there was a general permissive approach and that the law effectively needed modernising. So where we are is that a billing authority can, in essence, serve a completion notice by email, and it will turn on whether or not that is in fact received. So the upshot of UKI is a very permissive approach to triggering the statutory provision and a downgrading of disputes about service in favour of effectively looking at whether or not the document reached its intended recipient, rather than dissecting the precise legal consequences of the route taken to that recipient. Now, one area that might be left open after UKI is the position where the completion notice is wrongly addressed. So UKI was about a completion notice where the billing authority abstained from addressing the notice. To it was simply sent to the owner. They didn't attempt to name the owner. Well, what happens if they do attempt to name the owner, but they get it wrong? And arguably, this is outside the reach of UKI. But it seems to me UKI gives us a pretty strong indication of the way the wind is blowing. And the wind is blowing in a way that the approach from landlord and tenant law is likely to be applied. And it seems to me that the relevant question would be whether the way in which the completion notice has been drafted fairly conveyed to the recipient what the subject matter of the notice was. Now, that's the general position in rating in relation to a whether the property has been sufficiently identified. That's from a case of Henderson and Liverpool in 1980. I think a parallel approach would be taken as to whether or not a wrongly addressed notice which reaches the correct owner was reasonably understood by that owner. But one area that I think it is worth emphasising is that I think there will be difficulties in relying upon the deemed service provisions in relation to a notice that was wrongly addressed, because it seems to me that the deeming will only be of benefit where the notice is actually properly directed to the correct owner. If you get a set of circumstances where there is an incorrectly addressed notice or sent to an incorrect address, then one would have to, I think, demonstrate actual receipt of somebody that reasonably understood the notice to be triggering rights in relation to the property against them. And that will probably be a factual inquiry. But I would expect the courts to take a relatively permissive approach subject to a detailed examination of the particular circumstances which apply in any given case, because that is effectively the parallel approach that one can draw upon from property law. And my colleague at Landmark Chambers, Tom Weeks, discusses this in his book on property notices at pages 80 to 83, where there's a discussion about misaddressed notices in a landlord and tenant context. My expectation would be that that approach would apply in rating, because effectively UKI is lining up rating very much with the approach that's adopted in landlord and tenant law. So the final topic I want to just very briefly mention is the procedure for challenging the effectiveness of a completion notice. Now, it will be recalled that there is a statutory appeal under Schedule 4A, but that relates to the appropriate identification of a completion date. So it's all about the date on which the deeming provision takes effect. And that's the mechanism for debating when a property will be complete. But if you are trying to say no completion notice has been effective, either because it hasn't been properly served or there's some other fault that goes to whether or not any completion date can be fixed, or rather has been fixed, then the mechanism for doing that is to make a proposal to delete an entry in the rating list. Now, for a time it was controversial as to whether you could do that, but the Valuation Tribunal held that you could in a decision of the President of the Valuation Tribunal that's been reported from 2011, that's Prudential Assurance and Valuation Officer, that's reported in the 2011 Rating Appeals Reports. And that established the position, and that was confirmed by the High Court in the case of the Crown and Reeves Valuation Officer and the Valuation Tribunal from 2015. That's 2015 EWHC Admin 873. See the judgment of Mr. Justice Holgate at paragraphs 21 and 23 in particular. And so this establishes that if you consider that the completion notice hasn't effectively triggered it, you effectively say, I want to delete the entry in the rating list, and my reason for doing that is that the property isn't capable of beneficial occupation, and that is a mechanism which would allow you to challenge the contention that a date has been effectively fixed under the statutory scheme. That, as far as I understand it, is the orthodox position. It's been recently confirmed by a number of valuation tribunal decisions, and that appears to be the position that the valuation officer was positively asserting was the case in the Reeves case, and the reasoning of Mr. Justice Holgate endorses that analysis. So it's clear to me that you can challenge whether an entry should be made in the list by making a proposal to delete it, and in the course of that proposal, the Valuation Tribunal and the Upper Tribunal are entitled to reach a view as to whether or not a completion notice has been effective in determining a deemed completion date, or whether we are rather in the territory where it hasn't, and therefore you're applying the Port or Riviera tests that I referred to at the start of this podcast. So that's the position in relation to the procedure. Just then, finally, drawing the threads together from this podcast, the essential point is that the completion notice mechanism is critical in practical terms to establishing whether or not there is a hereditament that can be shown in the rating list. Without a completion notice, the question is whether or not the property is ready for occupation for the purposes for which it's been designed. If it's very nearly ready, but not quite complete, then it can't be entered into the rating list. What the billing authority has to do is to utilise the mechanism in the Act by serving a completion notice to put the matter beyond doubt. If that has been utilised, then the courts now are going to take a less technical approach and a more permissive approach to minor errors in that scheme following the decision of the Supreme Court in UKI, with the only caveat that UKI doesn't cover every conceivable scenario where the billing authority has made a mistake, and there may need to be some further litigation to establish the approach in other cases. It is, however, in my view, clear that you can make a proposal to alter the rating list, which raises the question of whether or not a deemed completion date has been effectively fixed under the statutory scheme. That brings this podcast to a close. I hope it's been of some interest to you. If you do have any comments or feedback, please feel free to contact me on LinkedIn or send me an email to dkolinsky@landmarkchambers.co.uk. That's dkolinsky@landmarkchambers.co.uk. Thank you very much indeed for listening, and goodbye.